Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome a great guest co-host, Dr. Brian Huggins from the UNC Department of Preventive Medicine. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me, Adam.
First, though, before we speak with our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett, about her work to bring global health really home to readers. What an exciting topic. I think that so many people are interested in global health. I'm interested in global health. And, you know, just see what she has to say and how she's gotten there.
Yeah, I'm in the School of Public Health here at UNC, so it'll be a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, first we got some interesting research that matters. And let's dive right into the very first one, which is about vaccine-preventable diseases. We have seen a surge in measles cases in the United States, over half the states, probably the most cases in 30 years, over 1,000 probably approaching. And this is since we declared measles eliminated in the United States in the year 2000. What's going on and why this research?
The big anti-vaxxer movement has picked up steam.
Anti-vaxxer meaning people who don't want to be vaccinated, but not necessarily because of religious reasons, but maybe because they think that there are things associated like autism with measles.
Right. Thanks for clarifying. Mm-hmm. And I just went to a conference where we kind of talked about this a little bit. One of the things that we struggle with on the public health side is we're based with facts. We want to present facts. And the people on the anti-vaccine side have these broad stories, and they really appeal to people's hearts, and not all of it is fact-based.
I knew someone who had autism, and they got a measles vaccination, and so therefore, those things. And so in this particular study, they wanted to – actually, it was an experiment where they had 574 students, 491 being pro-vaccine, and 83 being kind of vaccine hesitant. So the majority of people are pro-vaccine, which I think is good from a public health viewpoint. But they said, well, does it matter? Maybe give them a curriculum or give them an experience being exposed to someone who actually has had a vaccine-preventable disease. Like, they had shingles, and it was miserable and painful. Maybe they had even been in the hospital. They could have had a measles. And see, do they change how they view? Is it the curriculum that changes it, the story that changes it, or neither or both?
What's interesting for me is it's a lot like HIV and AIDS in the 80s, where when you saw people dying, people started having safe sex. Now that HIV is a lifelong disease, you're starting to see an uptick in HIV again.
There are teachable moments, and I think narratives is what they're really talking about. Mm-hmm. This was really, they found that 70% of the students in the study who interviewed someone who had a disease from a vaccine, preventable disease, so like measles, and they should have been vaccinated against it, they moved from vaccine hesitant to pro-vaccine by the end of the study, even mm-hmm. if they didn't have the curriculum. So, you know, a single experience, seeing it firsthand, trumped the curriculum.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising, because I think we focus so much on our science, but the reality is the science and of what happens to people is really important.
Yeah,
and that really does influence people.
Yep.
Speaking of influencing people, our next research that matter is at the very end of the life spectrum, and it's seniors who maybe are getting towards an end of their life, and what happens if they think that their life doesn't have purpose at that point in time versus those who think their life still has purpose? There were several questions here among 7,000 people who filled out a survey, elderly people. I enjoy making plans for the future and work to make them a reality. If I retire, but I want to learn piano or I want to start a new business, I think that would answer yes. I have a good sense of what I'm trying to accomplish in life. I live one day at a time and don't really think about the future. So if you answer these questions, it might really help explain those who end up finding there's a purpose still and those who don't. And if you don't, you were 2.5 times more likely to die from things like cancer and heart disease. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it's sobering. It says, like, I think when patients come in to see us in our clinics, I think we should kind of explore. We ask sometimes about depression, but I think we say, do you still find meaning in your life? And if they say, I'm struggling with that, that's a marker just as powerful, perhaps, heart disease and cancer as it is for many other things we routinely screen for.
Yeah, I agree. And I've even seen some things where when we move people into nursing homes, taking away that freedom also takes away some of their purpose because they don't have their house, they don't have their garden anymore, and it frustrates. It's tough and leads into that.
Well, talking about leading into nursing homes, our last research that matters is about nursing facilities, and it's not really going into the facilities because people are getting in with the Medicare and elderly, but it's when they leave. Do they leave at day 20, which seems like a lot more people leave at day 20 than leave at day 19 or 21. Okay, what's magical about day 20?
Yep. So, in case people don't know, so Medicare, this is without a supplemental insurance, of course, Medicare for days 1 to 20 pays the entire cost. From days 21 to 100, the patient is responsible for $170.50 per day. And if you go over 100 days, 101 days, you're responsible for full cost.
Yeah. So, these co-payments can be really expensive, and these facilities, it seems like they know when the patient's copays are about to kick in. Now, I wondered, well, maybe the patients also know when their copays are about to kick in. And if you give me a chance to go home and or sit in that facility and pay another $50, I may say, I'd like to go home, right? It's not like maybe that the nursing home's kicking me out. It may be that I'm kind of like booting myself out.
Yeah, yep, I agree. But what's interesting is the flip side where people that maybe could have gone home at day 10 are now, the research showed that people might be staying in till day 20 because of the financial incentive to the nursing facility as well.
Yeah, I don't think that's the patient saying, I want an extra day.
No.
And it were the people who were seen to leave on day 20 seem to be disproportionately kind of lower socioeconomic status, more likely to be minorities. But again, it's hard to know what's cause, what's effect. I think it raises questions. I think if I had a loved one, or I'm in a nursing home and it gets to day 20, we're going to have some serious conversations around day 15 about, am I ready to go? What's your incentive? What's my incentive? And let's make sure it's the best care for the patient.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett about her work to bring global health home for her readers. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Brian Huggins. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett about her work to bring global health home for her readers. Welcome to Your Health, Laurie.
Hi.
You know, it's so exciting to have you here with Your Health listeners to really explore the world of global health and you've traveled across the world, but I guess we'd like to know to start with, how did you get interested in journalism from a career that started off in science?
Well, I was working on my PhD in immunology at Berkeley and Stanford, and on the side, as a hobby, I started reporting on the sciences for a local radio station, and meanwhile, my department was involved in internal warfare at Berkeley, and it was really starting to fall apart, and I decided to take a leave and try this journalism bug, and I never went back.
And in journalism, what was the first thing that really caught your attention that was kind of something like you knew that this was really important?
I can't remember that far, but what I do remember is that when I first started working in radio news, news would come across on wire services. And if the news was considered very, very important, the wire machine would start ringing. And every now and then, there would be these ringers, and I would run over to see what it was, and it would be about some place I never heard of, in some part of the planet I only vaguely knew the location of, with some disease that I had never heard of, or worse, a disease that was a mystery, and nobody knew what it was, but it was killing lots of people. And this flew in the face of the dominant narrative of the day, and a narrative that, by the way, we're returning to, unfortunately, that infectious diseases didn't matter anymore. we had them conquered, and we should focus all our energies on cancer and heart disease, as if it was a question of balancing one against the other, as if that in and of itself was even a reasonable thing to say. But it was also incorrect, and here I was seeing all these strange diseases where they were describing people bleeding to death or hallucinogenic effects from high fevers and all sorts of strange things. And I found that I was collecting them. I would tear them off the machines and just started creating a file of all of this. And one of them was a disease we now call Ebola. I was in graduate school when the first Ebola outbreak we know of in the history of the planet occurred. And I was fascinated by the idea that something could be that lethal and never have been seen before, and we would not have any solutions for it. That here we were in high-tech America, rich America, and our scientists had no idea what to do. And it was just dumbfounding to me. And so I got very intrigued and definitely decided that I was going to have to go to Africa as soon as I could figure out a way to get there. And it stuck with me and resulted in my first best-selling book, The Coming Plague, which came out in 1994.
I'm curious about your time over in Africa. What was that like, taking the leap to go, okay, I need to be in this continent to actually be on site to experience this? I mean, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the first time I ever lived in Africa, I was very young. I was still only in my mid-20s, but it was an extraordinary experience. I learned more in a year in Africa than I had learned in all the prior cumulative education I had received. Pretty much everything that I was taught was a given in American society. I learned in a few months in Africa was untrue, including most of the fundamentals of medical science as practiced in America. I came away feeling like my head was spinning and I was in an entirely different world. And just to flash all the way forward to where we are today, one of the things that was so startling to me, just shocking, was to see that the number one killer then of children under 12 years of age in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, was measles. And to watch children die of measles, to hold a baby in my arms that felt like a hot coal on fire and have it die in my arms, was so shocking to me. I came from the generation that, you know, where measles was vanquished and we were never going to have to deal with this problem again. And now here we are all these years later, and in the rich world we have people refusing to vaccinate their children. And it's just so shocking to me, from having seen the ravages of diphtheria, of measles, having heard children screaming out with whooping cough, all of these diseases coming back because people in wealthy countries think, why do I need to have my children exposed to these so-called dangerous vaccines?
When you think about what you wrote about in another of your books, The Collapse of Global Public Health, did you foreshadow that kind of this rise of nationalism and suspicion of government might be part of this collapse of a public health movement?
Well, I wasn't brilliant enough to have foreseen the rise of nationalist governments around the world. But what I did see is that public health thrives in only one scenario, and that is a scenario of trust between the people and their government. And when that trust breaks down, and when people doubt anything that their government says to them, or the government abuses its people, steals from them, cuts off whole segments of the population, then public health doesn't work. And we could see that right here in America back in the day when I was writing the book, because there were communities all over the United States that were underserved and that had long-standing suspicions of government, such as African-American communities in inner-city areas that saw government as its enemy, or Native American communities living on reservations that felt the American government had betrayed them for 200 years. But traveling overseas, I really saw it, because wherever you had dictatorships, you had deterioration of public health. There are now some anomalies to that equation that have arisen since then. One is China, of course, which has built a massive health apparatus for its people, but is definitely not a democracy. And another might be Rwanda, which is clearly a dictatorship with a man who has made himself legally dictator for life, Paul Kagame, and yet they are having some excellent health achievements because that happens to be something that he gets a lot of foreign money to pay for. But overall, the rule holds, and it was obvious then. And the example I gave in The Betrayal of Trust, my second book, probably the single best example I could come up with of this notion of the link between trust in government and achievement, is what happened in 1947 when a tourist who had traveled through Mexico and then came traveling through the United States came to New York City and displayed full-blown smallpox. And of course, smallpox is incredibly contagious from person to person and had a very high mortality rate. And it was immediately post-World War II. Americans were the victors in that war, and there was just tremendous patriotism across America. People loved their government, their local government, their national government. People had fought a war to defend the nation, and they felt great. So when the Commissioner of Health of New York City said, "We have found one individual with smallpox and two other people have become infected. We want everyone in the city to get vaccinated." There were lines around the block. Everybody poured out and put their arm out and said, "Vaccinate me." And nobody objected when the government said, "We could do this most efficiently if we could come into your workplace or come into your school or come into your church." Everybody said, "Come on ahead. Definitely vaccinate us." And within less than 6 weeks, the entire population of New York City was vaccinated. I do not think there is any place in America today, no matter how dangerous the microbe was, where we could achieve such success today. Because everywhere in America, there's distrust of government, whether it's right-wing or left-wing, it doesn't matter. And there would be immediately people on the internet claiming there isn't really a reason to do this, or the vaccine is dangerous, or the government is secretly going to get your information and your privacy, or this or that. And we would have an epidemic before we would have 100% compliance with vaccination.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. And when we come back, I think we want to pick up on kind of what's what keeps you up at night. where are you optimistic? Where do we need to move forward? We're going to take a short break, but then we'll continue our conversation with Laurie Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, about her work to bring global health home for her readers. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett about her work that brings global health home for her readers.
So, Laurie, what keeps you up at night? What do you see the next big thing, and how are we going to approach it?
Well, I used to be able to say very honestly that, to the surprise of the listeners, that I slept very soundly and nothing really kept me up, because most epidemics were of human creation. Our own stupid activities potentiated it, and our own stupid activities were obstacles. That meant that we didn't have to wait for miracles to stop epidemics. But times have changed. And today, what keeps me up at night, and I can honestly tell you many, many, many nights of sleeplessness, is the confluence of issues of climate change, the climate crisis, and heightened risks to human health. I have now been in multiple epidemics where there's a climate link to the origin and spread of the disease, and into multiple situations of other kinds of health calamities where the climate change link is there. I was in the middle of the worst air pollution event in the history of China in Beijing when I literally could not see the cars down on the street out my hotel window because the air was so polluted. And I couldn't stop crying, even when I was indoors in an air-conditioned room, because the pollution was stinging my eyes so much, and I was wearing a gas mask. I have been in multiple situations where I can see that we as human beings are just not capable of coming to grips with an existential crisis, and it is an existential crisis facing us because it's just so big and requires so much international cooperation and so many sectors of economies and ways that people live on the planet will have to change to offset the danger that's coming, that we would prefer to just go through our day-to-day existence as if it were no big deal. It very much reminds me of being in first grade as a child and getting my very first lecture on nuclear bombs and what we were supposed to do if we, quote-unquote, saw the flash of a nuclear bomb, and being told where the nearest bomb shelter was and how to get under our desks and cover our eyes. And I knew when I was 6 years old that if I, quote-unquote, saw the flash of a nuclear bomb, I was dead. And if I survived, I didn't want to live the condition I would be in. I grew up in that existential moment as a child asking, can we survive nuclear war? Can we survive nuclear weapons? And now we're in something much worse. And I get up all the time in the middle of the night trying to think strategically, what is the plan? What can we do? How can I make people understand that we are sickening ourselves, that what we're doing to this planet is making all of us sick? It's not just a question of whether it's going to get hotter or the sea level is going to rise. It's already a question of whether or not we're breathing air that's safe to breathe, we're eating food that retains nutritious content, whether we're dumping so many antibiotic products into the environment that we're destroying the entire natural order of microbial life on the planet. And I'm just overwhelmed by these issues, and this is what now occupies me and devours both my time and my sleep.
Thank you for sharing. I know that from some of your work, I mean, you've been covering Chernobyl and radiation and toxic waste in El Salvador and really places where tragedy has occurred, and yet you write that complacency must end, and I can hear it in your voice that all of us being complacent because you think that the climate change clearly makes or causes all of these things to be worse.
You know, the problem with climate change, I think, is that it's so big, it's so massive, that as you try to grapple with it and try to imagine what role can you as an individual play in offsetting this catastrophe so that your grandchildren can live in a decent planet, it boggles the mind, and people get cynical or just shrug because they can't imagine an answer. You know, when you see countries in Asia shipping back, as Malaysia now is, all the recycled plastic bottles saying, we're not taking your waste, you have to solve this. Well, that was the one thing that most people felt like they could do, recycle. Well, you know what? It's a trivial issue. Do it, please, but it's not going to stop the path that we're on. The only thing that will stop the path that we're on is to radically change how we use fossil fuels, if at all. And I just find myself overwhelmed, and I can understand why it leads to complacency in the public, because there are no quick fix answers. There's not one vote or one step you can take that makes the difference. It's a total life change. It's a total reappraisal of what we as a species are doing on our planet. And I think maybe the kind of collective choice that I find the most distressing of all the options that have been put out there is all these Silicon Valley rich guys that want to terraform Mars and move to Mars. And my feeling is, if you could transform that planet into a livable place for human beings, why don't you fix your home planet?
I know you embody acting local and thinking global. Are there other local things that are trying to perhaps move in this direction?
You know, it's really interesting you bring that up. I'm looking out my window right now at a small section of an interstate highway that is starting to collapse. And this is a problem we're having nationally, is our infrastructure aging and falling apart. And we're beginning to have arguments about how to fix it. Big political arguments that go all the way up to the governor and, in fact, to the federal level of the Department of Transportation. And it's been interesting to watch an increasing segment of the debate is, well, should we fix it? Why should we continue to spend our taxpayer money to support the movement of 153,000 gas-guzzling vehicles a day on this little 1.5-mile section of failing highway? Maybe it's time to take that kind of $4 billion infrastructure money and put it into things that involve alternative energies, renewables, and a cleaner environment with better personal health for everybody living in the city. I think what we're at is a moment where all over the world, but especially all over Europe, you see cities making these decisions and these choices. And I can see that in the United States, it's harder for us to opt for the smart choice about the future for our grandchildren, and easier to just say, I'm going to keep driving cars for the foreseeable future. It's a pipe dream to imagine that we can move cargo some other way than with 18-wheeler gas guzzler diesel trucks. And I see that we have a failure of imagination right now. It's a failure to imagine how bad things can get, and it's a failure to imagine and grasp onto really wild, wonderful ways of solving these problems and of making our own cities and our own environments more exciting places to live in, and certainly healthier.
And Laurie, as we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners, or any tips for people who want to be more involved and want to be able to make a change?
I think one of the areas that's now getting a lot of exciting attention and that you can plug into pretty easily is the whole question of how we're going to save the utility of antibiotics. We've had two generations of human beings grow up without worrying that if you bumped your knee and got a bleeding wound, it might get infected and you might die or lose your leg or suffer meningitis or encephalitis, because we've had the comfort of effective antibiotics. But the efficacy of antibiotics is waning, and in some cases, people are now getting completely incurable diseases for which we no longer have any effective product that can kill that bacteria. One of my friends got a strange bacterial infection, and all antibiotics that were tried failed. His wife mobilized the entire University of California, San Diego, and four or five other universities to create bacteriophage viruses that kill bacteria to save his life. And, you know, it cost millions of dollars to save this one man's life. This is the beginning of a pathway we're headed towards if we don't begin to really embrace the need to use antibiotics in smart ways, don't overuse them, and certainly don't cut your use short so that you breed resistant strains in your body. We've got to fight to oppose antibiotic use as growth promoters in livestock. Most antibiotics are used in the livestock and agricultural industry, not to treat human disease. And your next drug-resistant strain of salmonella or streptococcus might come from your grocery store chicken, not from any antibiotics you ever took or any natural other exposure. And I think this is an area that every single citizen can engage in. It's all about personal choices. What products do you buy at the supermarket? Do you take the antibiotics your doctor tells you to take? Do you ask the doctor skeptical questions? Are antibiotics warranted? And, you know, begin to really have an acute sense of the need to see this as a precious resource that we conserve with our own intelligence and our own actions so that our children and grandchildren will grow up with the ability to kill off bacterial infections with the same tools that have kept us alive.
Well, I think these are incredibly wise words to get us to move away from a failure of imagination and to use a very simple advocacy for things that we know will make differences. I thank you so much for suggesting, writing, advocating to wake us up from complacency.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest.
We've been talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett about her global work over decades to really bring home global health in a way that can lead readers to make changes. We're going to put up some links to your books, Laurie. We're going to bring up some links to some of the things that you've been talking about so readers can get more in depth and hopefully wake up a little bit more.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for being our guest. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Brian Huggins. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes listening to our listeners' health questions. If a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, Brian, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I have spinal stenosis that seems to have gotten worse over the last 20 years. I have a hard time moving my neck and walking because of the pain. I had a primary care doctor who told me for many years that surgery was not likely to help, but injections also didn't help. I'm seeing a new doctor who says that I should actually get a surgeon's opinion. Do you think this could be fixed by surgery?
Well, I think the first doctor was more right than wrong, though I do think they were wrong. Because we do know, and I've had patients who have benefited from surgery from spinal stenosis, and it's not so straightforward. It requires a lot of thought. Though the vast majority of people, it's kind of degenerative, and it may not benefit.
Right. In my personal practice, I'd say it's about a 50%. 50% of the people that have chronic back pain improve with surgery. 50% actually either don't improve or get worse. Yeah. So it really matters where the stenosis is occurring.
And it seems that what patients prefer plays a large part into how they do, which is not surprising. We had an interview not too long ago, Laura, with a guest who talks about placebo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And how important your expectations may be on that. But there are some things that suggest that if you have significant scoliosis, if you have something that's already really another thing that influences your walking, like muscular dystrophy or something else that adversely affects. If you're depressed, you might not actually have a good outcome from surgery. On the other hand, if you're younger, if you're walking pretty good, if you feel better overall and live less other illnesses, and the canal stenosis is pretty bad, you will benefit.
Yeah.
We're setting you up for the perfect condition. Now, it's not work like that in real life.
No. One thing, especially neurosurgeons are getting better at choosing who is going to go for surgery. And one thing that is really needed is evidence that there is nerve impingement. If you clearly have a disc that's sitting on the nerves, those people are more likely to do better for surgery. Without that evidence, it really is risky.
I do think it'd be worth a consult, the neurosurgeon or orthopedist who does this sort of work. And generally, it's considered if you have disabling pain despite having the non-surgical treatments, that's when you should see a surgeon. So thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our next house call?
I was visiting my mom in Iowa recently when I came down with pneumonia. I've been pretty healthy most of my life, and I don't take any regular medications. The urgent care doctor did a chest x-ray and said that they were a little worried and wanted me to see a pulmonary specialist when I got home. But I actually feel much better now after a week of antibiotics, and I'm curious if you think another visit's really necessary.
Well, you certainly don't need to go back to that other urgent care center. Go out of town. You know, First off, we're glad you're better.
Yeah.
You know, it's scary when you're traveling and you get something like pneumonia, and then you go and you get an x-ray, which not so certain why an x-ray was done. They don't have to do an x-ray. If clinically you could diagnose and you're otherwise healthy, but they did an x-ray. Sometimes they see shadows on x-rays. Sometimes they may have seen pneumonia on x-ray. They thought you had pneumonia. They treated it for your pneumonia, so that's not surprising. I think a lot of times we say we want to make sure you have a follow-up to make sure that your lungs clear up. You know, are you a smoker? In which case, well, then, you know, maybe they saw something.
Right. And that's really the big question is, was it just pneumonia? Or did they see something, but they're not a radiologist, they don't want to mention it, and so you should follow up? I mean, one thing that I would recommend is odds are good that that x-ray was read by a radiologist. And if you contact the urgent care, maybe you can get that radiologist report. I think that would be important to know.
You get the dictator report. It may be just easier to go and see your primary care doctor and get an x-ray, you know, or at least get a clinical examination and talk with them. That's probably a good starting place as well.
Yep.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I have a ringing in my ears, and I've seen several doctors for it. Each one says there's really nothing they can do, and they all seem to tell me something along the lines of, I'll get used to it. But that isn't happening, frankly. Is there a specialist I should see?
Is you'll get used to it a standard treatment, Brian?
I've
never really heard of that treatment. You'll get used to it, you know.
Just take two of these and call me in the morning.
Right, you got a headache. You'll get used to it.
Here's the snake oil.
It doesn't seem to be the treatment that I would recommend. Though I do understand that a lot of doctors think, tinnitus, however one says it, that it's a chronic condition in most people, and they do have to kind of adapt to it. But there are emerging treatments. It's a complex illness.
Yeah, it's a growing diagnosis where more people are having the diagnosis and people just aren't okay living with it anymore.
Well, we know that hearing loss frequently can be a manifestation and associated with it, and it can be a chronic problem. And so this could be a real issue here. You have to see, are there medications you're taking that could be causing it? Is there some other disease going on? Do you have to actually have a CAT scan or an MRI? An ear, nose, and throat frequently specialize in these things. But there also are centers for tinnitus that really specialize this. And you may have to look up in a region, see, where's there a specialty center? Because there are some treatments that I would say most primary care doctors and maybe a bunch of ENTs don't do. One is called tinnitus retraining therapy, where there's a really complex set of trying to change the neural connections at what happens when you have the tinnitus so that you really won't have it as much. This could take a long time, and you need to be in multiple allied health professionals who really specialize in this. It could be an audiologist, it could be a physical therapist, it could be an occupational therapist. They're usually a team.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing that I would really recommend to people is really take a thorough history of it. Figure out, is there a time of day that it's occurring more? Is it seasonal? Are there things like that? Any history you can provide to these providers is really going to help them make a diagnosis and narrow down what's causing it.
Finally, things like biofeedback, stress reduction, cognitive behavioral therapy, and then possibly some medications. One can see this is a complex question. Deserves a better answer than I think you've gotten.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls, and we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can share any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest co-host today, Dr. Brian Huggins. You did a good job today.
Thank you so much.
And we want to thank our guest today, Laurie Garrett. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.